So welcome to our study for today, everyone. Let's look at our scripture for today, shall we? Which is from the Song of Solomon. We finished the book of Ecclesiastes and we're on the Song of Solomon, into which we jumped in chapter 8, the first part of the translation by yours truly. And today it's verses 3 and 4. With your left hand under my head, your right hand would embrace me. I am fully committed along with all the daughters of Jerusalem. Why awaken out of or into love until one feels so inclined? That is verses 3 and 4 of Song of Songs, chapter 8, or Song of Solomon, or also called Canticles. Song of Songs, Song of Solomon, whatever you want to call it, that's one of the names, Song of Songs, the one that we've used here for that book. It's written by Solomon also. So Solomon wrote or recorded many of the Proverbs, and also he wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. And he wrote this book, the Song of Songs, as far as we believe that this was one of Solomon's books, but it's written in part from the perspective of the Shulamite maiden. So maybe, in fact, it was partly written. Maybe she wrote this book in part, and he also wrote part of it, and they combined it, or it's a fascinating book. But this chapter looks like it starts out as being written by the maiden herself, because it says in verse 4, and also verse, where is it now? Let's see, verse, well, if you look later on, verse 5, leaning upon her beloved. That's not so clear, necessarily not clear as to who's writing it. It could be written about the person and written by the person also, but let's see. This chapter is a little curious. Verse 1 said, if only you had been my brother and I could kiss you, talking about apparently the perspective, from the perspective, that is, of the maiden. I would lead you and I would bring you into the house of my mother. I would furnish you with a potion of wine, perfumed with the fresh juice of pomegranates. With your left hand under my head, your right hand would embrace me. I am fully committed along with all the daughters of Jerusalem. So she's one of the daughters of Jerusalem who's saying this. She's one of the daughters, apparently. This is not part of some modern trend that says you can identify as either sex. This is a biological female, as indeed all of the Bible would also be in agreement with the idea, with that same idea that all females are biological females, males are biological males. It's a biological issue, male and female. It's not got to do with identification in the mind or any other way other than physical, that what a male and female is. And there are many, many other things that are in the world that are not apparently mentioned in the Bible, although I'm sure they'll be covered in some way. I thought for years there was no coverage of smoking in the Bible until I finally understood that smoking is part of Spiritism. And then I realized, of course, smoking is covered and it's not condoned in the Bible. It's not approved of. It would make sense because you're tampering with the breathing. Breathing of the life spirit, in other words. The breath is the life, the spirit of life that comes into the body, and you breathe out, you breathe in, you breathe out. And don't try to awaken love into or out of a person either. Is in the study for today in the Song of Songs, which is talking about love, which is a spirit also, but not necessarily the same exact spirit as the spirit of life, although it seems like it would be, doesn't it? Because Jehovah is the living God, and he is the personification of love. He's a person, a spirit being, who is love itself, really. And not a human form, but in an eternal spirit form that's never been created by anything or anyone. He was uncreated, whereas the first creation was his firstborn son, who is not equal to the Father. And so the whole Trinity idea is a falsehood. And the Bible's very simple, and all these corruptions that came about later are not necessary and they're not useful. But in our study of the Ark of Urartu, and the world will tell us that all these things are useful, of course, all the falsehoods to them are useful, but there's enough work to do, as you'll see in our study, without all the complication of the untruths. Now, Abraham was the son of Shem, descending by Shem. In fact, we're not even going to have a complete picture of the truth. There's just too much of it. And Arpachshad was the son of Shem. Cainan was the son of Arpachshad. Shelah was the son of Cainan. Heber, his son, Peleg, his son, Reu, his son, Sereg, Nahor, Terah. Or, in the Chinese tradition of that descent line, they're called Yu Chao, who's Shem, that is, his son Sui Ren, or Arpachshad, then Fushi, Shenong, Huang Di, Peleg, Reu, etc. So Peleg becomes the common ground between the two traditions, although I don't know that we have a Chinese tradition of Peleg or Reu, but they sound like those names could be actually Chinese, don't they? I mean, they're not, because they weren't in China. These two sons, even though Peleg was the son of the Yellow Emperor, or Heber, he was the son of Heber. But Heber, if he was Huang Di was the Yellow Emperor. So if he did, and if the Yellow Emperor didn't live in China, he certainly is recorded in the tradition of China, which goes beyond, and it goes back further than the most ancient tradition of that land that we call China. It goes back to the land of Shinar. That's what we've been finding in our study today, in the recent study of this article. Now, Peleg was the son of Heber, and he didn't go to China, so this descent line from Peleg on is in the land of Shinar. Abraham's descent from Shem defines him, since he's descended in this line, as Semitic. And it is noteworthy that the language of Naram Suin, who was one of the kings of Akkad, that language of the family of his Akkadian grandfather Sargon is Semitic also, as well as Arpachshad, from whom Abraham came. Shem had son Asher of Assyria, in other words, that name is relating to the name Assyria, and sons Aram, Lud, and Elam. From Genesis 10:22, the sons of Shem were Elam, and Asher, and Arpachshad, and Lud, and Aram. Just notice it's pronounced Aram here, but Aram is how we would typically pronounce it, if it weren't for the accent on the letter A there, which might imply Aram, but it could be Aram. The accent doesn't necessarily make it a long vowel. It's just that it's been the convention among some people to pronounce the accented vowels as long vowels. Abram lived in Ur of the Chaldees, from Genesis 11:28 and 31, where Terah was the father of Abraham, and Haran died in company with his father in the land of Ur of the Chaldeans, from verse 28. And in verse 31, Terah took Abram his son and Lot the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, the wife of Abram, and they went with him out of Ur of the Chaldeans. So Abram was raised in Ur of the Chaldeans. Now, Ur, the city, if we notice that it says here on Wikipedia in under Eridu, fascinating because we think Eridu, or I've written about Eridu as being possibly the place of the original Tower of Babel. It's not all that close to, but it's near, it's in the general country of the same vicinity of Babylon. But it says here it's 12, Eridu is 12 kilometers southwest of Ur. Not very far away. That's like 7 miles. 7 miles southwest of Ur is Eridu. So Abram was living very possibly within slightly more than a short walking distance from the original Tower of Babel. That's where Abram was brought up. According to, depending on where we believe the Tower of Babel was originally built, which might have been Eridu. If it was built in Babylon, it wouldn't be much further away, but I guess it would be. Let's see if we can find Babylon here. Do we have it here somewhere? Let's see. Aram Naharaim. There's Babylon. Okay, so Aram Naharaim was a place mentioned in our. It's going to be something we talk about today, I hope. But Babylon is. How far is it from Eridu? That's the question. We got a map, though. We've seen the map. I don't think I looked up the distance. So let's try and look up the distance. Distance. Eridu to Babylon. Wait a minute. No. That's from Ur. Yeah. 85 kilometers. Where's that? From Baghdad. Okay. Hmm. 150 miles southeast of Babylon. That's where Eridu is, according to thegreatinception.com. There we go. 150 miles, which still isn't very far, but there's a greater distance if the Tower of Babel was at Babylon between that place and Ur. And King Ibrahim of Ebla was a ruler at about Abram's time. Eblaite is closely related to the Akkadian language, as by the Ebla tablets, it's East Semitic, circa 2250 BCE. And the reason why it's said to be closely related in this sentence is because Akkadian, the empire of the Akkad dynasty, right, was dated at its beginning around 2300 BCE for King Sargon I, Sargon the great king of Akkad. So 2250, there's the same time period, 2300, 50 years earlier. And this other thing here, Ebrium, king of Ebla, allows Assyrian king Tudia, compare with Tidal, the use of a trading post from Treaty with Asher says that the king of Ebla, called Ebrium, allowed the Assyrian king Tudia the use of a trading post. Tidal, king of Goyim, is ruling in Abraham's day, as Genesis 14, 1 and 13 shows. Remember that Genesis 14 we saw during that exploit of Chedorlaomer, whom we identified as Ninus, that the king of Goyim was mentioned, and his name was Tidal. So that's very, very important. it seems to connect the time period of the Ebleite kingdom, or the kings of Ebla, with the kings of Akkad. And if we can get them connected in any way at all, time-wise is a great way to connect things, because then we know there could be a relation, you know, in terms of the contemporary languages and so on. It's very important, time-wise. That's what chronology means, everything. And that's what I realized as I was doing all my research, that the chronology meant everything. If I could get the right chronology, that would mean so much. And it does. Apparently means everything to not everyone will appreciate it, I'm sure, but it really means everything. You can't just change the chronology and still have the same facts. Tidal, king of Goyim, is a connection there in from the book of Genesis to this king, Tudia, evidently, because it almost exactly the same consonants, T and D, right? And the AL ending could just be like a suffix, and so the TD might be the most important part of his name, so it makes perfect sense. So Ebla is synchronized by the genealogy, so it's only in our chronology that it's synchronized, because only in our chronology, what am I saying here? Let's see. Yeah, only in our chronology do we have Abraham dated to that same time period of the dynasty of Akkad. It's only in our chronology that occurs. I mean, there may be other chronologies of very uncommon ones, not the common chronologies, because they date the deluge as the time that we date Abraham. I mean, most people date, like, the deluge happened in 2300 or something in the low chronology of the Bible, which is from the Masoretic text and other texts that disagree with the Septuagint version that we're using. Only our chronology, right? Or only the long chronology will agree. Other people using the long chronology from the Septuagint might get similar, but not the same as us, chronology or correlations, right, from the chronology. And the Ebla tablets reveal names Adamu, Hawa, Jabal, Abarama, Bilha, Ishmael, Ashurael, Esau, Mikael, David, names which are very similar to those of Abraham's family. Ebla is located in Tel Mardik, Idlib, governorate, Syria. So Syria is just north of Israel, right? Abraham evidently stayed a time in Aram Naharaim, which in English means Aram of the Two Rivers, and the Wikipedia entry for which I have open here. It was an important place, a biblical term meaning between the two rivers, which is similar to the name Mesopotamia, right, which also means that, which is a place where the Euphrates sort of has its big curve in it that allows this land between the two rivers. So it's the bend in the Euphrates is connected to it, is what they're saying in there. Now, what replaced Mesopotamia in Masoretic, Samaritan, and Syriac Bibles is this word, Aram Naharaim, in the passage where the Greek Septuagint Bible has Mesopotamia and the Latin Vulgate expresses it as Mesopotamia of Syria. So it's a northern or northwestern part of Mesopotamia, which is up north. It's in Syria, right? It's up north of Israel, which is where the land of Laban's family, for example, where they lived and where Jacob traveled when he went to get his wife from Laban, his relative, and whose daughter he took as a wife, both his daughters, Rachel and Leah. And Abraham lived in Ur Kasdim, which is in Chaldea, further southeast, closer to this land of Ur, which is near, closer to the Persian Gulf and closer to the place where the Tower of Babel was built. And Kesed was the brother of Cainam. And I found the Book of Jubilees. Ur, the son of Kesed, built the city of Era of the Chaldees. That was from Book of Jubilees chapter 11. But Jubilees chapter 8 mentions Cainam in verse 1, Arpakshad to himself a wife, and her name was Resu-ijah, the daughter of Susan, the daughter of Elam. And his son was called Kainam, as it says there. And then he found a writing carved on a rock. And he transcribed it and sinned because of it, for it contained the teaching of the watchers. The teaching of the watchers was about watching the heavens, right, and looking to find omens in the sun and moon and stars. We look for the times and seasons and recording what date things are from the sun and moon and stars, but they look for omens. Verse 3 of that. So Book of Jubilees is a great thing. I've found it on, in this case, it's on Sudepigrapha.com. But there are many copies of the Book of Jubilees out on the internet. So, the biblical home. That's right. Isaac sent Jacob to Paddan Aram to get a wife from there. And Aram is given land in the Book of Jubilees near there, the biblical home of Bethuel, the Syrian, Abraham's nephew, Jacob marrying, Jacob was the grandson of Abraham, and he married two daughters of Laban, the son of Bethuel. All the references from Genesis we have given here, and Haran is where Terah brought Abram along with the rest of the family when they moved from Ur of Chaldea. Haran is in Aram Naharaim, right, or Paddan Aram, in the northwest from Ur. It's up in Syria. It's even sort of quite a bit north of Syria, maybe, or up in the northern part of Syria. As the Bible has it, this place where Laban lived was Paddan Aram. And the Book of Jasher gives Abram as 55 years old on his first arrival in Canaan at age 75. And that's from the Book of Jasher. Okay, let's find that again. This is the Book of Jasher. And Abram went and returned to the land of Canaan. And by the way, I made an error there and said it was verse 25 in the text. I'm going to change that and edit that, hopefully soon, when I do the major overhaul of the typographical errors. But verse 25 is where it says, they came to go to the land of Canaan. But first of all, he just returned to Haran, right? He returned to Haran, verse 20 of Jasher chapter 8. We're in Jasher chapter 8? No. 13, Jasher 13. Right, 13 and 20. And Abram returned to Haran. Then verse 26, it says, Abram was 75 years old when he went forth from Haran to return to the land of Canaan. That's exactly what Genesis 12 says, isn't it? I believe that's from my memory that it says that. In verse 4 of chapter 12, Abram was 75 years old. So he went out from Haran. That was his permanent move from Haran, evidently. So there's a bit of a, you know, a possible contradiction if you don't see all of this. You know, there could be some people who take that as a contradiction, but it looks like it's fine when we interpret it this way, because in Abraham's 10th year in Canaan, Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, battles against Nimrod and routs him from Jasher 13:12 to 15, a date making Abram 65 years old. So 2206 minus 65 is 2141 BCE, 600 years after our 2741 BCE dividing of the earth, which was 541 years after the deluge had ended, which we gave mention of above, right? So that's exactly 600 years, which is another thing about the genealogy. It has some nice numbers in it that are convenient, that they're divinely inspired. I saw it. There was a Christian joke I heard on the internet the other day, which I'm going to modify just a little, but to make it what I think is a little bit better, but just a little more universal. But they said, you know, Jesus is divine, and the branches are the branches, right? So anyone who knows the Book of John might understand what that is about. But we have, our chronology has some beautiful mathematics, for example, arithmetic, like 5550 being the creation of Adam is a number which is exactly equal to 7 1/7 times 777. And where do you find that in any other chronology on earth? But Abram also, in this case, was 60 years old at the time when Chedorlaomer went on his grand expedition in Genesis chapter 14. And that would mean when Abram went back to recapture his relative Lot, who had been captured by these armed forces, Abram was 60 years old. So that would make even today somewhat more sense for people in terms of how old people are when they go to battle, that the age of 60 is pushing it nowadays. But back in those days, of course, it wouldn't have been nearly as trying of a, or unlikely of a circumstance for somebody like Abraham, who lived to be, how old did he live to be? I'm trying to remember now. What was the age of Abraham? I think it was 100 and, how old was Abraham? Let's see if we can find it. I'm going to look for 75 and see if I find it. 75. There's 75, right. Let's see. Abraham died at the age of 175 from Genesis 25 and 7. Right. So at the age of 60, it's even more understandable that he could have been fighting a battle based on that. But so perhaps the age is not so critical as it might otherwise have been, if once we start to believe that these people really did have the longevity that the Bible says they had in the book of Genesis, and also according to the Septuagint rather than some of the later traditions that don't allow the chronology to align properly with things like the dynasty of Akkad, for example, the dynasty of Akkad that we're talking about today with the 2300 for year one of Sargon the Great. So now let's see if we can continue. We're on the last portion. Oh, I've refreshed it. Well, because I had to reboot the browser. I found out that rebooting the browser sometimes fixes my problem, which is great to know. It sometimes fixes my problem with my audio not working. So let's see what we can do now. This is the final portion of our video. This is the expeditions, not our video, but the expeditions of Thor Heyerdahl, the raw expedition, part two. This is part 9, I believe. So part 2-9, the final part of the movie.
Don't forget the spear!
No. Welcome to the American side of the ocean.
No sooner had they sighted land than a number of small boats came up. Outside the port of Bridgetown, the sail of Ra, with its symbol of the sun, went on for the last time, and the Culpeper towed us through the traffic into port.
They are given a great welcome by the people of Barbados, the Prime Minister, and an American delegation from the Knights of Malta. This time, Heyerdahl has reached his goal. After 57 days, his paper boat, Ra 2, has sailed more than 3,000 nautical miles right across the Atlantic. In dock, they can see that Ra 2 is virtually undamaged, except for the bow and stern, which they themselves have sawn off. The bottom is completely covered with barnacles from the long voyage. Scarcely one reed is broken or loose, although they have absorbed water to their maximum capacity. The flexible reeds have proven to be more resistant to the beatings of the ocean than the strong, rigid timbers.
The voyage of Ra had proved that the papyrus boat neither sinks nor disintegrates on a voyage into the open ocean. It had also proved that it was possible for men to live together in peace, even under stress and difficult conditions, and irrespective of nationality, skin color, political background, or religious beliefs, as long as they cooperate for common survival. Contrary to all scientific opinions, it was perfectly possible to cross the Atlantic in an ancient type of reed boat. In studying the origins of pre-Columbian civilization in ancient America, science must, in the future, take into account the fact that it is possible that some ideas, some inspiration, might have reached the Indians of tropical America long before the dawn of written history.
Magnificent. That was a Norwegian-Swedish expedition, I just learned. And that's it for today's study. It is October 4th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 18:52 hours North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. Thank you for being with us. I love you very much. And on my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie, saying bye for now.